Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
It's a situation in which we were not able to talk openly and honestly and in a balanced way about socialism, how to compare the strengths and weaknesses of socialism with the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism, so that we could have a debate about the economic system, so we could identify ways we could make this system either work better or replace it with a better system. The way an honest community talks about any of its systems in an effort to make them better.
Socialism. Don't mean to scare you there, just setting a tone for the discussion we're about to have today with our guest, Dr. Richard Wolff, a noted economist, professor, and expert on socialist economic theory and history, and fear of fears, an avowed Marxist. Greetings once again. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen Brown's co-host for another edition of It's Our Money. Today, we're going to spend a little time with Rick Wolff to get some historical perspective on why the word socialism has acquired a boogeyman quality for so many older generation Americans, and why it's not scaring most of the younger generation of people who are looking for some alternative to the chronically debilitating aspects of American capitalism. Capitalism and socialism are the underlying system mechanics of the public wheel and determine who wins and who loses within their economic systems. One might say that capitalism necessarily produces winners and losers, while socialist systems ostensibly try to more equitably arrange the sharing of wealth. This conversation arises more vividly these days when income and wealth inequality have left millions by the side of the economic road, causing untold hardships, squashed dreams, constant struggles, insecurity, and more. But can any one system correct all of these problems? Is there a future for socialist-styled economic planning in America? Or have we already dipped into the commie cauldron, as some might imply? Rick Wolff will make it clear how this economic evolution fits into the needs of our country and our time. Also today, we'll pick up our visit with author and historian Mike Jacobs, who wrote the official centenary book about the Bank of North Dakota. In our first visit with Mike, we talked about the economic and political context of the bank's creation 100 years ago. It's a colorful and fascinating recounting of how people on the prairie motivated events and survived instigating personalities to create a new kind of institution that has made all the difference in that state's history and remains today as the only publicly owned bank in the country, which, by the way, is also its most profitable bank. As you know, public banking is finally getting its due across the country, as several dozen cities, counties, and states consider some new way to manage their finances that minimizes profiteering extractions by the private commercial banks. Today, we'll look a bit deeper at the personal challenges that confronted North Dakota citizens and politicians during their revolutionary beginning steps of the bank and its partnering institutions. That is, how they managed to retain the baby while throwing out the bathwater it came in, if you'll allow a folksy metaphor. Mike will be along later in the show. But Ellen has another valuable article out this week that addresses a hot new item on the horizon of public awareness, the discussion about whether and how we can actually afford that most touted, quote-unquote, socialist-like public policy prospect called the Green New Deal. An approach being adopted worldwide, by the way, to reverse the devastation being caused by the capital-driven fossil fuel empire, while also prioritizing solutions to social and economic inequalities. It's a very tall order, and both the GND, as it's called in brief, and socialism are now front and center. Many reactionaries are scaring folks with the claims that the GND would cost far more than we can afford. But Ellen has a clear view, based on historical precedent, that we can do it, and must. All this has brought forward an unusually wonky topic: modern monetary theory.
The whole basic idea, I think, is good. The idea that the government can spend a lot more than it's spending right now without creating inflation, because there is a lot of unused productive capacity in the economy. Even though technically we're supposedly close to full employment, we really aren't. I mean, everybody knows that all those people working at Walmart or whatever, I mean, there are a lot of people that are not being used to their full potential. They're working part-time jobs, or and there's machines. You know, there's just a huge productive potential that's not yet being used. But my concern about MMT and about modern monetary theory and about the millennials jumping on it, I'm afraid they might not understand the the technicalities, and they'll get hit with economic arguments that they don't really know how to respond to. So where I think the problem is with MMT is that they say that whenever the government spends, they create money, and that therefore they just need to spend more, and then we'll get more money out there in the economy, and that's what we need. We need more money in the economy. I agree we need more money in the economy, but the government doesn't create money when it spends. It is not allowed to borrow from the Federal Reserve. In other words, it can't write an overdraft on its account at the Fed. Its checking account is held at the Fed. So when it buys something, it writes a check on its Fed account, but it must have the funds in its account before it writes the check, which means it can only get the funds from taxes or from selling bonds. In either case, the money is already there. The tax money and the bond money was created by banks when they make loans. So new money, virtually all new money in the system, comes in when banks make loans. And then the Fed accommodates that by creating new reserves. If they need more reserves, then they buy bonds on the open market. So the Fed gets the bonds, and the seller of the bonds gets new money created by the Fed. And that's how the Fed does create new money. But the Fed has no obligation, as the Federal Reserve itself said in a paper that I quoted, that they have no obligation to help the government with its deficit. Like, they can buy bonds or not. Whether they buy bonds or not is not contingent on whether the government deficit spends. It's contingent on whether the banks need more reserves, and that's when they create it. So I have to agree with the American Monetary Institute on that point, that money is actually created by banks when they make loans. The Fed is working for the banks. The Fed is not working for the government. It doesn't respond to the needs of the government, or it doesn't need to. So it seems to me the other thing that's, I mean, MMT is not even in the Green New Deal as it's written, but public banks are. So it said in the original proposal, it said it would be funded by public institutions, including the Federal Reserve and a public bank or a network of public banks. So we would envision that to be a network of state-owned banks, let's say, or city-owned banks that could resort to the Fed for help with liquidity, capitalization, et cetera. In other words, it would be a network with the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve could do quantitative easing for the people. In other words, a form of QE that actually gets into the real economy, not the kind that has been done to date, where it only gets as far as bank reserves. And for a model for that, we have the European Green New Deal, which is ahead of ours. They started theirs in 2008, or made their first proposal in 2008. And that's what they are favoring now, is a network of public banks, including their development banks, which I wrote about before, like KfW is a development bank, or China has a lot of big development banks, where they're basically recycling existing money, but they're putting to work the money that is otherwise sitting idle. Like, corporations have a lot of money that they're not investing because they don't have customers. They could be buying these government green bonds. And then it's the same principle as Roosevelt's New Deal with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, where the Reconstruction Finance Corporation sold bonds, used the money to make loans to all sorts of productive things, and then the lenders or the borrowers paid back the loans with interest, and so the result was to pay back the bondholders and generate a profit in the form of interest for the government. So that was my point.
Well, you know, I've got to say it's such a circuitous scramble of arrangements. It seems to me that I do not understand why our central bank, our sovereign money issuer, can't just issue money without having to pay interest.
Right. The Fed should be able to buy those bonds directly, hold them on their books, make them like 100-year bonds or 1,000-year bonds or something. In other words, don't sell them back. And it would just be the same as printing new money. And that's the thing. MMT says that's what they do, but they don't. If we want them to do that, Congress has to change the law. And that's what these young millennials should be working toward, is a change in the law that it would allow the central bank to fund the government directly in some form, or fund a green bank directly or whatever. All this ferment is really very interesting. I mean, it's the very fact that people are talking about monetary reform. That's actually Truthdig just posted my article, and they changed the title. But my original title was that monetary reform takes center stage, which has never happened before. Like for 100 years, I can remember a social creditor writing to me once, for, you know, this is 1920s was the social credit theory. And she said, we've been trying to get some public attention for a century. And she said, you don't know how lucky you are that you're riding the wave here, where all of a sudden these things are becoming relevant and interesting and newsworthy.
I appreciate that you've laid this out yet again for us to look at, about how to fund the Green New Deal and to push back against the reactionary extremes that this is going to cost us $50 trillion and all the fear-mongering that's going out to say this can't be done.
Right. It can be done. I mean, the Green New Deal itself is very controversial, and I'm, you know, there are definitely parts of it that I don't approve of myself. But from our point of view, we're interested in how you would fund any sort of large project that Congress decided was a good idea without actually taking sides on the merits of the legislation itself. We're talking about monetary policy here, how to fund something big.
Yeah, the point is that we can afford what it is that we need to have.
Yes, abundance can be ours. We've got the people, we've got the workers, we've got the materials. So all we're lacking is the money, and the money can be had.
And I think that can give credit to MMT for raising that reality into a much more discussed topic.
Yeah, it's great that they've gotten these ideas out there.
Well, let's go talk to Rick Wolf.
All right.
Thanks, Ellen.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Richard Wolf, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he taught economics for 35 years and is currently a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. He is also co-founder of the nonprofit Democracy at Work and is in great demand as a public speaker. It's so great to talk to you again, Professor Rick.
Oh, thank you very much, Ellen. The same here.
Yeah, so we were just saying in pre-record that you were saying how at one time you weren't in much demand as a speaker, and now all of a sudden your socialist leanings are in big demand. Do you want to just mention
that? Yeah, I sometimes present this with a simple statistic that in the last 4 years I have done more invited speaking than I did in the previous 40 years, just to sort of make it as dramatic as I know how. It's a heady experience. It's a kind of astonishing. It reminds me of what a famous political leader of 100 years ago was noted for saying. He put it this way: for decades, it seems as though nothing happens, and then in a few weeks, decades happen. And I think that's exactly what we're going through, that we made it in America a taboo ever since the end of World War II. That we're talking here the late 1940s, a period that is almost 70 years now, or 80 years. It's a situation in which we were not able for all those years to talk openly and honestly and in a balanced way about socialism, how to compare the strengths and weaknesses of socialism with the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism, so that we could have a debate about the economic system, so we could identify ways we could make the system either work better or replace it with a better system. The way an honest community talks about any of its systems in an effort to make them better. This was impossible. And so those of us who recognized this, those of us who felt the what was missing in American political and economic discourse, felt very much on the outs. When I would talk about what was wrong with capitalism, you know, I'm a teacher. I looked at my audiences, whether they were students or older people, and I could see that they were nervous about the very conversation. They deeply understood, even if they couldn't put it into words, that there was something very taboo, that what I was talking about politically was inappropriate, a little bit scary, maybe smacked of being disloyal in another scary way. And so we couldn't do it. And audiences didn't think of it, didn't want it, were alienated from it, you might say. And then, I know this takes a long time to develop, but then after the crash of 2008, it literally overnight, or at least it appeared that way to us, everything changed. And suddenly, people were very clear that the economic system left a lot to be desired. They were losing their jobs. They were losing their incomes. They were losing their homes. They were finding their savings disappearing. And suddenly they wanted to know what was wrong with the economy, what made it work so badly, at least for them, et cetera, et cetera. And I am the, you know, beneficiary, if you like, in a certain sense, by suddenly having the critical perspective that people wanted to consider. They didn't necessarily agree with me, but they wanted to hear it. They wanted to think about it. They wanted to see whether a good case be made for a critical perspective. And I've never looked back. I mean, each year I say to myself, how long can this continue? Only to be surprised that by the end of the year, the things are even more bubbling for people like me than they were at the beginning of the year. Let me give you an example. I recently made a trip up into New England to give a speech at a college. And the audience was there, 250 students in a pretty rural place. And I was there to debate, and there was another professor who took the opposing position. Okay, here was the topic, which, by the way, the college chose, and they used a very prestigious fund at their college that had been endowed by some wealthy alumnus, I believe, to fund all of this. They brought the two professors, myself and the other fellow, and their topic was, quote, and I'm quoting you now, is capitalism worth saving? Question mark. I didn't come up with that title. And to tell you the truth, if they had asked me, they didn't, but if they had asked me what kind of title I might propose, I wouldn't have dared to propose such a thing, fearing it would not be well received to make such a proposal. But I didn't. They did. And the students, you know, there was not an empty seat in their auditorium. Students were lining the walls, sitting on the carpeted floors to listen to me make the best case I could that capitalism is not worth saving, and to hear the other fellow make the case that it was. And these are just new experiences, and I turn down three or four for each one I accept because I literally can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and I think it's largely, it is the younger generation that's quite disillusioned with, I mean, they've definitely gotten a raw deal. They're not coming into the same easy conditions that we did, well, that I did in the 60s, for example.
That's
where
right.
It was, anybody could get a job, you could go through, you could work your way through school as a waitress. I mean, it was things are cheap, yeah. And it's not just socialism that's gotten popular, but monetary theory in general.
It's amazing that the MMT folks are able to get under the skin of Krugman and the others as they have, and that Stephanie Kelton, a person I've known for many years, is in a position of debating with them and being nicely pointed in her commentary. Yeah, everything is changing.
Yeah,
you know, and
a woman.
For me, it's a sign of a system that's in it's in trouble. And when it's in trouble, it has to kind of open up the way a human being is. You know, you can be very reserved and very self-reliant, but then when the problems of life hit you, as they will everybody else, then it becomes really important to have other people to talk to hear how they see the world differently, to help you grasp things that you were not clearly seeing before, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. A woman wrote to me from England. She was a social creditor, and she said, I mean, this is like probably 2008, I don't remember, and she said, you don't really realize how lucky you are. She said, we've been beating this horse for 100 years, and nobody's paid any attention. But it used to be that everybody, that like the Federal Reserve, the central bank was the holy of holies, and you didn't question. You just assumed they knew what they were talking about, and it was boring, and it was going to be way too deep for you, and things were going along fine. But now, first of all, people are a lot more educated on that subject, and it's obvious that they don't know what they're doing, or that things can go wrong, and they do go wrong. So,
I remember, you know, in years of teaching, trying each semester to get across these things, that after a while I began to realize you have to kind of reopen people's minds so that they can listen and hear what you have to say. And one of the things that worked for me was to lean across the podium. I sometimes taught classes at the university with 400 and 500 students, these introductory courses to economics, which, by the way, I love to do. And I would lean across the podium and I would say, you've got to understand, nothing is under control. It's not all in good hands. It isn't all going to work out. You have to open yourself up. Otherwise, your need to believe everything is okay is going to close your brain down so that you don't see all of the manifold signs that that's not the case. And so, example for the Federal Reserve or for the government, just to repeat, you know, a little bit of the story of what led up to the crash of 2008. Obviously, these people didn't know what was coming. Obviously, they hadn't taken the steps to prevent it. They couldn't even recognize what was happening until literally those last 4 months of 2008, when the whole economy crashed in on all around them. To suddenly imagine that these people who couldn't see the train wreck coming are going to be in perfect shape to get us out of the train wreck after it's happened really makes no sense.
So, speaking of socialism, do you want to define, like, what are we talking about with socialism? President Trump said in his State of the Union address that the U.S. will never go socialist, and meanwhile we have Bernie Sanders, of course, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proudly claiming the label. So what is socialism? What's democratic socialism? What's the difference between that and a progressive or even a conservative?
Yeah, let me work at that a little bit with you. First, I can't miss an opportunity to remind everybody of a little history. The last leader of every single country that went socialist, whether it's Sweden or China or Soviet Union or Cuba or Vietnam, the last leader before it went socialist always gave a speech in his or her parliament telling the world that their country would never do what it then promptly did. So Mr. Trump is following in the footsteps of others in a way he will be sad to think about, if indeed he thinks about such things at all. Having said that, let's turn to socialism. Well, here's the problem. Socialism is, and the very name is what I mean now, at least 200 to 300 years old. It has existed in literally every country on the face of the earth. Every country now has a socialist party, almost everyone, or it has a socialist trade union, or socialist intellectuals, or socialist magazines. In other words, socialism has become, in a historically short amount of time, a global phenomenon. If you move that quickly across the immense different cultures and politics and economics of the world, in a couple, 200-300 years, you're not going to be the same thing in every place. That is, people don't agree on what socialism is, and they never have. There are profound disagreements. So while I would enjoy being able to answer the question, what is socialism, with a nice set of three or four sentences that get it across, if I did such a thing, I would be intellectually dishonest, because I would be hiding from you and your listeners and the folks that are interested the range of differences. And the same, by the way, is true of most other important things in the world, like capitalism or freedom or democracy. We don't mean the same things, and that has to be put on the table. People are more than smart enough to cope with alternatives to what these words mean. All right, so let's begin. Initially, socialism was a term given to people by themselves and by others who said that the world is an evolving place. We've had an economic system we call tribal or primitive or village economics. We've had slavery as an economic system. We've had feudalism. Now we have capitalism. But these socialists said it's in the nature of the human experience that economic systems come and go. They are born, each of them, they evolve, and then eventually they die away. And capitalism is no different from all of the others. At least there's no reason to think so. And we know that capitalism was born in Britain in the 16th and 17th century. We know it spread from there to become the global system it is today. And therefore, it's born, it's been evolving. And this may depress some of your folks here listening, but it is going to die like every other system, unless you have evidence that I've never seen or heard that I should believe this system will live forever, unlike every other system that preceded it. And so for these socialists, it wasn't a question of whether capitalism would pass into something else. It was a question of what would it pass into? And for these people, their experience of capitalism contained enough negatives, enough things they saw in capitalism that they did not like, that they decided the world could and would do better by organizing itself in a radically different way. And then they had a variety of notions of what that might look like. And the ones that became kind of the dominant ones were the idea that the problem of capitalism was that it gave way too much power, way too much wealth to way too small a minority of people in it. In other words, that capitalism was a system of inequality, that capitalism gave way too much power to those who had the disproportionate amount of wealth, and that socialism would be a system that didn't do that, that would distribute the wealth much less unequally, and correspondingly the power, the political power especially, correspondingly. That's why socialists always liked democracy, because the distribution of political power in the idea of one person, one vote, making all the key decisions was always attractive. And so the socialists became the critics of capitalism, the people who decided it needed to go through a change to be something else. And it developed with a focus on the following, that property was one big question, that there shouldn't be a situation where relatively few people own what they call the means of production, own the land, the buildings, the machinery, the factories, all of that, while the mass of people were simply the employees, the people who came to work, got paid a salary, but who used the salary to keep themselves going, and so they could never join the ranks of those who owned the wealth, who got the profit, which made them more wealthy, etc. So for these people, socialism meant that you should remove the property, redistribute the property. It should not be held in the hands of a few. It should be shared by everybody equally. They had a variety of ideas of how this should be done, but the basic thing that united socialists was this notion of the socialization, they called it, of property, taking it away from a minority so it would serve the majority. And the second big idea, and that's really only two, the second big idea was that the market is not the institution we should be using, the way capitalism does, to distribute resources and products. That the result of letting the market do it is that the people with the most money get whatever is scarce, get whatever is considered valuable. And the socialists always thought that there are much better ways and much better rules for distributing whatever is scarce in a society than by giving it to the richest person. And they would use examples like, if there's a scarcity of milk, should the milk go to the wealthy people who want to feed it to their cats? Or should it go to the mass of people who want to feed it to their babies? It seemed so clear to socialists that the distribution based on a collective democratic notion of the community's needs was a better way of distributing than the market, which simply gave whatever was scarce to the people who had the most money. And so socialists were in favor of socialized property and democratic planning of the distribution of products rather than letting the market do it. And for much of the 19th and 20th century, those were the basic ideas. And so when people made revolutions or voted for socialists, what they were really voting for was one or another version of controlling the property and controlling how markets work, or superseding markets by means of planning. Some socialists were very modest in what they wanted. And in a way, Bernie Sanders is quite modest. He doesn't want to take property away from the private capitalists that own it. He just wants the government to step in and what you might call make capitalism gentler, less harsh, make sure the taxes distribute a bit more evenly than we now have our wealth distributed. Make sure that the capitalists who own and operate the businesses do so in a more socially conscious, more egalitarian way than they will do if the government doesn't look over their shoulder and regulate what they do. And then you have the much more aggressive kinds of socialists who don't want to give rules to private capitalists. They don't think they want to be in a position where the private capitalists are trying to evade or get out from under whatever regulations they can impose, and so they want to take over. We call those people communists. They, by the way, call themselves socialists. And the split between socialists and communists had mostly to do with whether the government would limit itself to regulating and taxing. That came to be the kind of socialist idea. And then the communists who said, no, the government should own and operate the enterprises and should control the whole thing, because if you wanted the economy to work for everybody in this society, well, then the government represents everybody and they should do it. What we had then was some countries like Russia and China going the communist route and other countries going the more moderate socialist route. And by other countries, I mean particularly the Scandinavian countries, Germany in many ways, France, Italy, and so forth, where they don't have the government take over very much, but they do have the government regulating lots of things. And those have been the experiments of socialism to our time. But here comes the really important thing. because of the dissolution of the Soviet Union back in 1989, and because of the changes in Eastern Europe that happened around the same time, a kind of soul-searching has gone on among socialists and communists, wondering whether they hadn't made some big mistakes, usually the kind that are associated with names like Stalin and so forth. They begin to worry that the amount of power they gave to the government produced a new kind of problem. It wasn't the old problem of capitalist running society, but it was the new one of a government that had too much power. And they kind of had to face the failures of that first wave of socialist experiments. And so what you now have, and that's why I said there are different interpretations of socialism, you have the idea that what socialism should mean is not so much the government replacing private capitalists, because that's still a small number of people, the politicians, replacing another small group of people, the big capitalists. And that what really socialism ought to mean is the real transfer of ownership, operation of enterprises, and all the political power that goes with it directly to the people. And what that means is to convert enterprises, the factory, the office, the store, from the way they are run under capitalism and the way they have been run even in the communist societies, where a few people at the top make all the decisions, whether it's a private board of directors in a corporation in Western capitalism, or it's a group of state officials making the decision in the Soviet Union or in China. It shouldn't be a small group of people, whether they're private or government, making the decisions for the vast majority of working people. That in fact the working people can and should run the enterprises themselves, and that if you want a real democracy, it has to begin by democratizing the enterprise. You have to convert the stores, the factories, the offices into workplaces that are democratic in the very specific sense that everybody who works there, each person has one vote equal to decide what the enterprise produces, what technology it uses, where the production will take place, and here's the big one, what is going to be done with the profits that all of the workers in the workplace have helped to produce. The argument of these socialists is, if you want a real democracy, and if you want to take the big step beyond capitalism, then you have to get rid of the employer-employee difference. You have to make the employees become their own employer collectively. In other words, to convert a top-down hierarchical capitalist enterprise into a collective democratic worker cooperative. And that's what the thrust of socialism should have meant. But now, in retrospect, having seen what other kinds of socialism ended up with, this is the new direction. So today, if you're going to be honest and have a conversation about socialism, you have to recognize that you need to get out from the person who's talking about it which kind of socialism they have in mind. Bernie Sanders is the kind of moderate Scandinavian type, which he himself says. Ocasio-Cortez, well, she's sort of there, but she wants to push it a little further. Both Bernie and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez do make nods in the direction of worker co-ops, but they don't stress it. And so there are still other kinds of socialists, say, for example, me, who are pushing the worker co-op as the thing that is the crucial number one priority going forward now in the kinds of socialism that have to be advocated, because the capitalist system in which we all live is in the deepest difficulties of its history.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would suggest there's another type of socialism. I read about Korea, South Korea, that they figured out that you didn't have to nationalize all the means of production. You only had to nationalize the banks. And then you could, you know, if the government owned the banks, then it controlled the flow of resources.
Right.
The flow
that's
of capital,
been,
anyway.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, other
so that would be a public
that.
Banking system. Sorry?
Yeah, a few years ago, you had a socialist win the election in France. His name was François Mitterrand, very famous politician, president of France, very dignified. But that was his view, too. For him, and he was, by the way, elected by the majority of the French people, and he was also the head of the Socialist Party in France, which has held power in the French government on and off many times in the last several decades. Mr. Mitterrand, immediately after being elected, basically transformed the banks, some of which had already been transformed earlier into government institutions, but he immediately took steps to basically nationalize the banking system. And he used an argument very similar to yours, that socialism should be understood, he said, as a mixed economy. It leaves some of the enterprises in private hands in the conventional capitalist way. But it also puts the government in a very powerful position to shape the conditions under which the private capitalists work by controlling credit, by controlling who gets what lines of credit to undertake what sorts of investment, et cetera, and that this kind of a mixed economy was what he meant by socialism.
Mm-hmm. That's also what Chavez did in Venezuela, nationalized the banks, and that might be when people don't talk about China, you know, when they're criticizing socialism, and China's doing brilliantly well, better than we are, obviously, in terms
of
growth.
Yes, I love that. I think, Ellen, that there isn't a more important kind of question imaginable, because
they point to Venezuela instead.
Yeah, this crazy notion that Venezuela is some demonstration of the failures of socialism. I mean, it is so baldly nonsense, it takes your breath away. Right next door to Venezuela is Bolivia. They have a socialist government. They're one of the best performing economies in Latin America. Or take China. China is in practical mourning because their economic growth rate this year is in the neighborhood of 6%, which puts it at double or more the rate that the United States can achieve this year. And for the last 20 years, China has been the number one growing economy in the world. If you remember that most of the world is poor countries whose number one priority is to get out of their poverty and to have economic growth, then they're all looking to one place, and it isn't the United States. It's to China, because China has for 25 years now ranked number one year after year in the rate of economic growth. They've gone from one of the poorest countries on our planet to a superpower economy, second only to that of the United States. It's a story of economic success and growth under a socialist government and run by a communist party. And all of that is conveniently brushed away because of this enthusiasm that they found a country with a socialist leader that's having great difficulties. Socialism is not the end of economic difficulty. It's the changing of society in important ways so that you have different kinds of difficulties and that you handle them in a different way. Socialisms are different from capitalisms, but they're not some heavenly nirvana where all your problems disappear, and no reasonable person should ever think that way, let alone talk that way. If any of this has been of interest, please take a look at our websites. One is called Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O. And the other website is my name, rdwolf, with two Fs, .com. And both of those will give you lots of information, both about a criticism of the capitalist system we live in and advocacy for worker co-ops as the new direction forward.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Richard Wolff, professor of economics and co-founder of the nonprofit organization Democracy at Work, available at democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O.
And now we go back in time to the founding moments of America's only public bank with another visit to North Dakota with author and historian Mike Jacobs, who wrote the new definitive centennial retrospective on the Bank of North Dakota, that miracle on the prairie that we celebrate here as the anchoring institution and proof of the viability of public banking in America. Now as then, when the people get a great idea and band together to change things in fundamental ways, they run into trouble, and sometimes even each other. In this second visit with Mike, we learn about how the best-laid plans for governmental policy changes had to face off against vested interests, cultural sentiments, and personality conflicts. It started 100 years ago, when the newly elected Nonpartisan League brought a series of bills that created new institutions and new methods for management of state affairs.
The legislation passed in late February of 1919 was far-reaching. It created what the League referred to as the industrial program, principally the state-owned mill and elevator and the bank, and a home loan program and a tornado and fire insurance program. Importantly, it did a number of other things in terms of government reform, so to speak. It created a board of administration which combined a number of the institutions in the state, the colleges and universities, the eleemosynary institutions, as they said in those days, basically the charitable institutions, state hospital, the state prison, all of those lumped under one board of administration. They also created a state printer and mandated the publication of official notices in a single newspaper in each county. Those are the sorts of things that got them into a great deal of trouble because they were seen as overreaching, an interference in excessive centralization, I guess is what we might call it. And particularly, the League had resisted the seating of Minnie J. Nielsen, who was elected superintendent of public instruction. The fight over the occupation of that office, who the legal holder of that office was, became a gigantic distraction and led to the notion that the League was interested in some sort of world domination is a fairly strong term, but that they had an interest in centralizing the government and exerting power in ways that were not really part of the industrial program. So the League itself and the League's method of government became controversial, while at the same time the industrial program went forward without as much rancor as was directed at the Board of Administration, which in hindsight was a terrible mashup. At one point there were two investigations going on at the largest colleges in the state, one political faction seeking to fire one president at the Agricultural College in Fargo. The president there had been sympathetic to the League, and the League board seeking to fire the president at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, who had been sympathetic with the what was called the Independent Voters Association, which was anti-League. So you had a very high-profile investigations going on while the League was attempting to establish its industrial program. So the issue with the recall and all of that and the referendum and all of that in 1921, which resulted in the League being turned out of office, has roots that are far more complicated than opposition just to the industrial program. In early March of 1919, the opponents of the industrial program began a campaign to dismantle the League's program through the referendum of the bills, establishing the Industrial Commission, the bank, the mill, and the Board of Administration, and so on. That election was held in June of 1919, and the League institutions were upheld. Then there was the legal test, which I wrongly referred to earlier as the 48 taxpayers. The Independent Voters Administration sought plaintiffs in each of the counties of the state. They fell a little bit short. There are 53 counties. They found 48 plaintiffs. That was the case that was brought in the federal court in North Dakota, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that the state did have the power to create these industries, to engage in these businesses. So that brought the state to the actual establishment of the Bank of North Dakota and the Millen Elevator in the early summer of 1919. The bank itself opened for business in downtown Bismarck in late July of 1919. There was controversy about the organization of the bank. Attorney General William Langer, who was elected on the league ticket and then apostatized, so to speak, turned against the league. He opposed the hiring of the league's candidate to head the bank. General manager, he was called. So there was controversy in the early days, but they did get the bank up and open. I believe the date was July 28th, 1919. And the bank opened for business. Deposits were called in. The state deposits were called in. Deposits were called in from subdivisions, to some resistance, of course, from cities and counties and school boards. But the bank did open for business. It was open at that same location until the new building was constructed in the early 2000s. So the bank was at that same corner. It had been a car dealership. That same corner from 1919 until 2006, I believe. 80 years. Over the course of the years, the bank has attempted to present itself in different kinds of ways. And at first, its interest was to be quite austere in its appearance because it wanted to present itself as a economizing rather than profit-making, so to speak. So when I was but a young adult beginning to be aware of these things, the bank presented itself with a Western motif. Now, an architecturally striking building. It's meant to recall the steamboat traffic on the Missouri River, which brought the fur trade and eventually the importance of Bismarck and the state.
What you described is something that, in the earliest moments of the bank, sounded to me like a personality conflict within the politics of the nonpartisan league, that while holding on to some of the policy objectives that the league brought forward, the industrial plan, you called it, undermined by the personalities that were driving this motion.
Well,
that's a fair characterization?
Yes, it is. I have to caution you, everybody interested in the bank, that the relationship between William Lemke, who was the author of the bank legislation, and William Langer, who was the attorney general initially elected on the state ticket, the relationship between the two of them was complicated from the time they met one another as students at the University of North Dakota until Lemke's sudden death in 1950. Langer had a grudge because Lemke invested heavily and invited various of his acquaintances, including Bill Langer, to invest in land in Mexico. And Langer came from a relatively prosperous family. They were important landowners in the southern Red River Valley in Cass County, west of Fargo. And of course, anyone who has paid any attention to Mexican politics knows that there was an important pushback against American imperialism, shall we call it, in Mexico in the teens. Pancho Villa came along, and there were various swings in Mexican politics. Lemke essentially lost control of the land. His dreams of essentially recreating the agricultural boom of the northern plains in the United States in coastal Mexico evaporated. Langer had invited a group of investors to Mexico. Langer went down, and on his way back to the United States, he found himself behind the lines in the north of Mexico and blamed Lemke essentially for putting his life in danger and for losing his family a good amount of money. So he distrusted Lemke. Although they were both involved in the Nonpartisan League, they became opponents because the league ran its candidates, remember, in the Republican primary. And so they became political opponents. After the recall and the trough in the league's fortunes in the late 20s, Langer recaptured the league and turned it into what amounted to a political organization. He was a Prairie Populist, but his importance in the bank story, in the beginning of the bank, has been overrated in North Dakota history because he outlived Lemke. So this whole bank story plays out against not just the ambitions of North Dakota voters, or the aspiration, shall we say, the ideas that they brought with them from Northern Europe, the ideas that they were hearing in their political meetings and their church meetings and talking about at their community suppers. It wasn't just the influence of socialist thinkers who were present and certainly had a big influence. It was also the personal ambitions of individuals. And Langer particularly published a very damaging criticism of the League in which he basically dismissed it as socialistic and Bolshevik, and he used the word red with, I would say, careless abandon. Most North Dakotans have forgotten that because it's part of our history. There, you know, even during the Depression, Langer used the bank to good effect to prevent precipitous farm foreclosures and started a student loan program and the like. So his operation of the bank, although he had been opposed to the bank in the beginning, not in the very beginning, but in the controversy, largely responsible for the controversy about the bank and the league program in 1920 and 21, he saw the ruins of the league as an opportunity for his own brand of populism. So it's a very textured and complex story. The immediate impact was that Langer forced the league to hire not a banker of his choice necessarily, but somebody that the banking community in the state trusted, so that the league candidate was sort of pushed aside in favor of F.W. Cathro, who became both the brains and the management of the bank. That was an important decision because he essentially made a pledge of faith, a pledge of good faith to the state's bankers and said, you know, we're not after all your business. We're after a way to manage the state's enterprises in a sound financial way. This is a dramatic political story. And it's a cautionary tale because there are a number of ways to attack state banking, and opponents of the Bank of North Dakota employed several of them.
That's Mike Jacobs, author and historian of the new book, The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, the First 100 Years. We'll continue our visits with Mike through this centennial year to revisit the formative days of the nation's first public bank, a period of time now reflected by the national efforts underway to create new American public banks. We highly recommend this lovely volume of photos and narrative, and thank Mike for his sharing it with us in person. You can find the book on the Bank of North Dakota website at www.bnd.nd.gov or through your local bookseller or Amazon. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.